She decided to change her title and what she's going to talk about. But this will be great. And the title is Explain the Cambrian Explosion.
Yeah, well, I thought I should also maybe explain my switch. About, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks ago, I started thinking about, I read a few papers and started thinking about potential projects for some new grad students. Simultaneously, I just really wasn't looking forward to hearing myself talk about rates and patterns of evolution in Lake Pinon again. And so I said to my grad students, maybe I should just sort of make this more like a discussion and pose some questions and get some feedback. And they all thought that was a great idea. Bless their hearts. Now I've changed my topic to explaining the Cambrian explosion. This is not something that I've been working on for a long, long time. And so as I got closer and closer to today, I have to admit that it seemed like a less and less great idea. Huge gulfs of ignorance opened up around me. But it's a really compelling topic, and there's so many different branches of geology and biology that need to go together to address the issues of the Cambrian explosion, that it seemed like a good thing to do is to sort of get together with some biologists and talk about it a little bit. In terms of the Cambrian explosion, I'm sure that all of you are aware that this is one of the favorite topics of proponents of intelligent design. You can buy this T-shirt for $15.95 from this website, idofcourse.com. The T-shirt you can see is about the Cambrian explosion. M evolution, the big M is for macroevolution. The world swarmed with living creatures before the Cambrian era. This is more or less a quote from Darwin. Fact, 40 phyla of complex animals suddenly appear in the fossil record. No forerunners, no transitional forms leading to them. A major mystery, a challenge, the theory of evolution exploded again. So like I said, the Cambrian explosion is really one of the favorite things for ID people to focus on. They take things more or less out of context that scientists have said and harp on them to conclude that this is the main thing that we cannot explain from the fossil record. I would certainly agree that it's mysterious and challenging in many ways, but all of these questions I don't think are better addressed by just turning to a deity, as I am sure you will agree with me there. So my plan for today is to talk about, just to sort of present to you some of the basic patterns of the Cambrian explosion, a little of the background, and basically the history of the Cambrian explosion. And this will be hard to sort of condense because there are many, many topics in there that could go on for an entire course about. But anyway, I will condense that. Then I'll talk about some proposed explanations, some ways that paleontologists have tried to deal with these possible explanations. And then I'm not going to end with conclusions. I'm going to end with questions and hope that we can have a conversation about some of these ideas that are out there right now. So this is not a regular research talk. This is just supposed to be more like a conversation illustrated. So here we go to set the context. Most of you, I think, are used to working on living things, and so we have to take a few steps backwards and just look at the whole sweep of Earth history. So we have a 4.5 billion year old planet. 88% of Earth history is the Precambrian. This whole big swath of time, and then the Precambrian-Cambrian boundary is right here that we're going to end up focusing in on right here. But to set the context in terms of the history of life, of course, at least by 3.5 billion, if not earlier, we have evidence for bacterial life on the planet. This is an extremely interesting interval, and it would seem to me that at least as soon as we get rocks that are capable of preserving life, there it is. And so life may have a deeper history than this. But anyway, we certainly have bacterial life for 3.5 billion. The timing of the first eukaryotes is a little bit uncertain, or it's quite uncertain, probably somewhere in the vicinity of 2 billion, or perhaps slightly later than that, we have evidence for good eukaryotes. And so this huge swath of time here, from 3.5 to about half, this zero shouldn't be here, it should be over there. Certain things happen to my slides when I transferred computers, between computers. But anyway, this huge swath of time here, some people call slime world, basically there were billions of years when life was here on the planet, but it was just single-celled, which is an interesting time, of course. Then when we go up towards the end of the Precambrian, there are a few things that are that seem to be really important and sort of mark the or set the stage for the Cambrian explosion. At the very end of the Precambrian, in an interval that's also called the late Neo-Proterozoic, there's really good evidence for at least three major glaciations. Some people have coined the term snowball Earth, which is meant to represent an entirely frozen over planet. Other people are more happy with a sort of slush ball hypothesis that maybe the Earth wasn't completely locked in ice, but there were at least parts of the oceans that were open water during these intervals. But the evidence is really, really good that in the late Proterozoic, there were these the most major glaciations that the world has ever seen. The strict snowball hypothesis argues that the oceans all the way down to the tropics were frozen over maybe to a depth of a kilometer. So we're talking a major freeze. And so each one of these glacial intervals lasted for some period of time and then finally came out of the freeze. This is two Harvard geologists posing next to a huge drop stone. There's evidence for glaciation, like I said, all over the world, including in the paleotropics, and some of the evidence is in glacial tills and also in these things called drop stones, which are among my favorite rocks, where you have relatively fine-grained water lane sediments that all of a sudden in the middle of the sediments you get these big pebbles or cobbles drop down, and the only way to get those big, huge pebbles or cobbles out there in these aquatic settings is to raft them on a glacier, and then the glacier melts a little bit and drops its load down into the water. So that's what they're standing next to. And so these are rocks in Namibia. These are glacial deposits, and then above them are these thick so-called cap carbonates that represent a major thaw after this glacial interval. It's thought that the control on all of this is CO2, and while the Earth is locked in this deep freeze, volcanic activity, of course, doesn't stop, and so the CO2 builds up and up to the point at which you cross a threshold and you get melting. So anyway, there are these really major environmental happenings at the end of the Precambrian that whose position in time is close enough to the rest of these activities that it's worth talking about them. Then, a little bit later, or basically just after this, in the late Precambrian, we get the Ediacaran fauna, which is probably at least a little bit familiar to most of you. And here are some of the fossils on the top and a couple of reconstructions on the bottom. The Ediacaran fauna is the first multicellular things that we can see in the fossil record. They're large, usually a centimeter or two, but up to a meter. This guy up here in the corner can be up to a meter. So they're the first large, architecturally complex organisms that we have in the fossil record. They occur all over the world in this interval, 575 to 542 million years ago. They don't have hard parts, they're just soft-bodied, and there are some sort of special conditions of preservation that give us these impressions. They're preserved under an event bed, so it's thought that, you know, they were living in the mud, and then maybe there was a storm or some other sort of event that catastrophically buried things, and that's why you get them preserved. But they're on all continents and all over the world in this interval. So this is mostly here. I have this diagram again in a little while, but this is mostly here to show you the timing of the Ediacaran. So this is one of these snowball episodes or deep freezes. Here's another glaciation, and then this is the third, probably more like a regional glaciation here. And then here are the Ediacarans. A couple of suggestions of Ediacarans down here, but then the bulk of the Ediacarans occur right here, just at the end of the Neoproterozoic, and then they seem to completely disappear at the Precambrian-Cambrian boundary. There are a couple of suggestions of Ediacaran organisms up above, but for the most part, the Ediacarans just go away at the Precambrian-Cambrian boundary. What were they? This is a question that geologists have been worried about for a long time, and we don't have final answers just yet. But the current thinking goes something like this. The Ediacaran biota was a mix of both stem and crown group radial animals, so the radial phyla here being the cnidarians and the porifernes. We get those in the Ediacaran fauna. We get some stem group bilaterians, so maybe some stem arthropods, etc., that you can see here. But also in the Ediacara, there seem to be a bunch of so-called failed experiments, things that didn't go anywhere after that. They didn't lead to anything, not related to any of these phyla, and maybe some other eukaryotic kingdom. So it's a real mix of different things. And I don't really have time to go through the history of thinking on this, but this is, I think, a reasonable current summary of where we are in the Ediacarans, that they are a mix of cnidarians and porifernes, both stem and crown group animals in those phyla, and then some stem group bilaterians. In the last 5 million years of the Ediacaran, we do get some lightly skeletonized forms. And these are the first skeletons that we ever get in the fossil record. They're sort of funny-looking things. This is a really strange thing called Mammacolophus that you can see is from Namibia, that people have done a lot of 3D visualization on fossils arranged in different ways and come up with this as a model for what the whole thing looked like. And then these are little nested cones that are lightly calcified that are called cladina that may have lived like this. But exactly what these things were is really unclear. But they come in right before the boundary with the rest of the Ediacaran things. And then there's one other interesting formation at the end of the Neoproterozoic, the Dushan II formation in China. It spans about 20 million years here at the end of the Neoproterozoic, but most of the important fossils come from about 570 million years. It contains these little things, which were originally described by Andy Knoll and his Chinese colleagues as animal embryos. Since then, people have X-rayed these and studied them in a variety of different ways, and made some different conclusions, so it's currently sort of controversial, to say the least. Some people have argued that they are just some kind of stem group metazoans. Other people have argued that there are these sulfur oxidizing bacteria, and some of you may know more about this than I do. There are these sulfur oxidizing bacteria that look for all the world like these little fossils from the Dushan II, and so that these represent nothing more than these giant, some kind of giant sulfur oxidizing bacteria. So the exact meaning of the Dushan II formation is uncertain at the moment. So here's the sort of big picture then. We've got all this time with just bacteria and single-celled eukaryotes. Then right here towards the end of the Precambrian, we've got snowball Earth. or some version thereof, and the earliest multicellular organisms. And then what comes after that, of course, is the Cambrian explosion. So first I want to, before I get into the body fossils that mark the Cambrian explosion, I want to talk about the trace fossil record real briefly, because that's actually really important. Trace fossils, of course, are just the marks of animals or organisms moving around in the sediment. When we look in the late Precambrian, we can find widely accepted trace fossils that begin around the Ediacaran times, but they're all very, very simple meandering traces across the sediment surface. So nothing's going down into the sediment is the main point. In the Neoproterozoic, these are little just traces across the bedding plane, and they're fairly small. This is a millimeter. These are millimeter bars. The base of the Cambrian, then, is marked by the first sediment-penetrating trace fossils, and those are shown here. There's a particular ichno taxon, trace fossil taxon, called Treptychnis pedum, and these are rocks collected by Mary Drozier and others in the southern part of Australia, where you can actually see bioturbation in the rocks for the first time. You can see real sediment-penetrating burrows. These are the rocks in X-ray that show this sort of more mottled texture than you get in the Precambrian rocks, where you can see burrows on the surface, but if you look at the same slab in X-ray, you can just see the flat-lying bedding. So this has been known for a while and is widely accepted that it's really after the boundary that you get the first sediment-penetrating burrows. And then, sort of as a prelude to what's going to come, I just thought I would throw these in terms of trace fossils, because one of my grad students is working on these kinds of traces. Trilobites make really cool trace fossils, and this is a picture of trilobite tracks and trilobite burrows looking up from below at the bedding plane into which these trilobites burrowed, at least temporarily, or hunkered down in the sediment for whatever reason. So shortly after the first sediment penetrating burrows, we get, of course, a very complex trace fossil record. So this is, here's another way of looking at this last interval. Here's the Precambrian-Cambrian boundary. And then here we have the Cambrian divided into early, middle, and late. And even the early Cambrian has, you can see four different stages here. And it turns out that the Cambrian explosion sort of takes a while to unfold. Obviously, there are a lot of things that were unfolding down here in the latest Precambrian. But then when we get into the early Cambrian, it's taking a while for the explosion to completely unfold. In the first stage of the Cambrian, we certainly get those sediment-penetrating burrows, which are why that mean that we certainly have larger coelomate animals. There are a few small shelly fossils in that first stage of the early Cambrian, but it's really in the second stage of the early Cambrian, the Timotian, where we get these small shelly fossils. And so the Timotian is the age of these little shelly fossils. Some of these are no doubt individual animals. This is probably some kind of, or almost certainly some kind of primitive mollusk, for instance. But some are just components of animals. This is probably a sponge spicule. This is probably just one of many little plates on some kind of worm-like organism. And what exactly these things are is, your guess is as good as mine, really. But the point is that all of a sudden we get all these little shelly components, some calcium carbonate, some calcium phosphate, some from known phyla, but others we don't know who they belong to. So that's this little wave of the Cambrian explosion right here, the Timotian. And then what follows that in the Athabanian stage, basically then all of a sudden we get the first abundant recognizable body fossils, including the trilobites, whose real heyday is the Cambrian, and so they begin their Cambrian ride right down there in the Atavian, the sort of later part of the early Cambrian. This is an early echinoderm that we get down there as well. So now, moving up just a tad, there are two really well-known Cambrian Lagerstätten, or special deposits where even soft-bodied taxa are preserved. I assume most people have heard of the, most people in here have heard of the Burgess Shale, which is in the Middle Cambrian. The Xinjiang fauna is in the Early Cambrian, so it predates the Burgess Shale. And these are just a few of the many different taxa that we get in these soft body deposits. And so basically by this time, you can see there's all kinds of different taxa, certainly lots of arthropods, but we even have chordates and a variety of other things in the soft body fauna in the Burgess Shale and in the Xinjiang. And so by this time, basically, the Cambrian has exploded. I mean, the diversity is there. And so that was sort of a step-by-step through these patterns. Here's this is a figure from a paper by Charles Marshall in the Annual Review of Earth and Planetary Sciences just a couple of years ago, where he talked about the Cambrian explosion. It's a really good paper. And this sort of sums up all these things. The Gaskier's glaciation is that last major glaciation. Right after that, we get the Ediacaran. We get horizontal trace fossils below the boundary, and then vertical trace fossils begin at the boundary. Small shelly fossils begin at the boundary and really take off in the Timotian stage. There, in terms of diversity, like it says, the phylogenetic uncertainty of so many taxa makes it really hard to count the diversity in the late part of the Neoproterozoic, but then certainly diversity increases a lot through the Cambrian, the early and middle Cambrian. This is a figure more or less meant to show the same, to summarize the same geologic and paleontological evidence. This comes from another really nice review paper that's a little bit older by Andy Knoll and Sean Carroll. And this one, time is going from the right to the left. And so here we've got the late Neoproterozoic, and here's the Cambrian. This one shows the different phyla a little bit better. And basically what I showed you before, in the Ediacaran times, right here in the latest Neoproterozoic, we've got the stem groups of some of these bilaterian phyla, and of course the record for the periphera and cnidaria goes further back. But this is supposed to show the patterns, and then it also shows this big increase in diversity with classes shown in blue, orders shown in green, going from not much at all, and those just appearing in the latest Neoproterozoic, latest Precambrian, and then this big swing up in the early Cambrian, all these different taxa. Okay, so those are the patterns in a nutshell, and what I wanted to do now is talk about how people have gone about explaining these patterns. Obviously, I think, you'll see, this is something that all of us have to work on, I think, at the same time. 20 years ago, Doug Irwin, Jim Ballantyne, and others published this paper where they talked about the Cambrian explosion, and they sort of put it in the context of Phanerozoic diversity history. And so here is the famous Sipkowski curve of family level diversity. And so this is now the Phanerozoic. The Precambrian is just, the latest Precambrian is just shown right here with an older name. But the Cambrian, Precambrian boundary is right here. So they said, well, let's look at this in the context of major long-term radiations. We've got this one here that took place in the Cambrian and the Ordovician, where you produce about 450 new families. And then we also have an interval right here that follows the Permian extinction. where you've got 450 new families coming in over pretty much the same amount of time. So both of these intervals began during low diversity times, both produced approximately the same number of new families. Let's compare them. When you look at the number of phyla and classes and orders, however, they those two radiations are quite different. The early Paleozoic, which would incorporate the Cambrian explosion and the Ordovician radiation that came afterwards, excuse me, the early Paleozoic was this huge burst of morphologic invention and produced a lot of new higher taxa. So if we look at the phyla here, this is the Precambrian, and then this is the Cambrian interval, this one right here. The black squares are durable skeletons, so brachiopods, mollusks, echinoderms, things like that. The white squares we can almost ignore because what their position here is just marks where we happen to find them in the fossil record in other cases of special preservation, and nobody thinks this really marks their first real occurrence. And so most people think that, in fact, these phyla probably first originated way back here. Anyway, that's what those white squares are. So if you look at the phyla or the classes, basically they all came around in the early Paleozoic. And in the Mesozoic, there were no really new morphologies, no new phyla, no new classes. You get some new orders sort of scattered along, but it's really, this is what has always marked the Cambrian explosion, is that you get these real, these higher taxa of the new body plants coming in from the beginning. And so what the way they posed the question 20 years ago is this: why is evolutionary innovation concentrated in the early part of the Paleozoic? And they proposed these two different ideas that aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, but two different sorts of explanations for this this outburst of new body plans at the beginning of the Cambrian and no new body plans since then. First is the ecological hypothesis, basically saying, arguing that the Paleozoic was an ecological setting of really great opportunity. There was nothing in it, and that's why you get this burst of new body plans. Or the genomic hypothesis, and their version back then was that early metazoan genomes were very loosely programmed, and then later on, as metazoans continued to evolve, development became more and more tightly controlled, and therefore innovation was more and more restricted. I'm sure that you are all aware of the fact that we have made, not we, you, some of you, have made incredible progress looking at the development of genetic programs in the last 20 years. But still, I just thought this was a good sort of historical context for the ideas. Before we go any further with just those two ideas, the genomic idea and just the ecological setting, I wanted to talk, just say a few more things about environmental factors per se, because I think you can't, it's probably at least partly all of the above in terms of genetic contributions, ecological contributions, but also environmental contributions to the Cambrian explosion. There are all kinds of physical things that are happening, most of them connected with each other, that are certainly relevant to explaining the timing and the patterns of the Cambrian explosion. So you've already seen this, but the idea is that a lot of these things are interconnected with events that certainly would have had an enormous influence on life. About a billion years ago, you formed the supercontinent Rodinia, and then somewhere in here, that supercontinent began to break up, so the breakup of that supercontinent, certainly, there are lots of reasons to think that the breakup of the supercontinent contributed to the onset of these snowball episodes or these major glaciations, and so there's certainly a tectonic context for precursor to the Cambrian radiation and perhaps the Cambrian radiation itself. A lot of geologists have argued that the coincidence of all this life, first the Ediacara biota, and then immediately after that the Cambrian explosion, the coincidence of these things coming right after these major glaciations is too much to ignore. I don't know exactly why a huge freezing crisis like this would then instantly give you all these new body plans, so it's more sort of a coincidence in timing than an explanation, but it's certainly, I think, an interesting thing to sort of put into the mix. Then we've got this Precambrian-Cambrian mass extinction. There's a variety of different evidence that suggests that the Precambrian-Cambrian boundary was not just marked by the first appearance of the shelly fauna and all these other things right above it, but that it also marks a mass extinction boundary for some of the plankton, marine plankton. We see extinction events. And also this, which I haven't mentioned yet, the Delta C13 curve, people looking at carbon isotopes, you can see there are some really major things going on with the carbon isotope curve across this interval. These may be related to the glaciations, but then right at the boundary, you have this big negative excursion in carbon isotopes. There is no widely accepted explanation for this, but we also know that there's a big negative excursion in carbon isotopes at the Permo-Triassic boundary, which of course is the most extreme mass extinction in the history of the Phanerozoic, and so it points to some kind of global catastrophe, which certainly would have influenced the life on the planet. It's fairly short-lived, and then above that, boom, already is the Cambrian explosion. So the Cambrian explosion, the boundary is marked by trace fossils and to a lesser degree by body fossils, but it just at the boundary is also this major carbon isotope excursion, which suggests some kind of big catastrophe. And then finally, this is an idea that's been around for a long, long time, and it continues to be supported by geologic evidence, although it's really hard to nail this down. But there is a lot of reason to suspect that oxygen was increasing over this time interval, and the pattern of the increase is hard to pin down, whether multiple thresholds were crossed or one single major threshold, but it's certainly the case that to get big organisms, you need to have a significant amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. To get big complex organisms, you certainly need to have oxygen. So it's unclear if this is a just a threshold that needed to be crossed or an actual stimulus for the Cambrian radiation in and of itself. But these are really important environmental things that have to figure into the whole picture. I'm going to skip this and go on to some things that paleontologists have done. For a long time, people working on trilobites have noticed that when they look at early trilobites, like Cambrian trilobites, it's really hard to decide who's a species. There seems to be a lot of intraspecific variability. So, for instance, the early Cambrian groups seem to be characterized by high intraspecific variability, whereas groups that appear later on do not, and it's easier to recognize species. So this was kind of a pattern that people sort of knew about but hadn't really quantified. In the early 90s, Nigel Hughes, who's a trilobite guy, and he was actually here a couple years ago and gave a talk right here, he did a study looking at the variability in thoracic segmentation, just counting up the number of thoracic segments in Cambrian versus post-Cambrian trilobites, and he collected some data that seemed to confirm the pattern that I just described, that you get really high variability in early Cambrian groups and then less variability later on. And so he suggested that this indicated that the genetic system was less strongly canalized early on, and then sort of became more and more rigid, and so that was reflected in the lack of intraspecific variability later on. And so nothing really happened after that for a while. That particular study was it was restricted in the number of trilobites they were looking at, and it was restricted in the fact that they were just looking at the segmentation of the thorax and counting up the number of segments, and so it didn't seem to have really wide applicability. Mark Webster, who was a student of Nigel's and is now at the University of Chicago, tried to address the issue, the same issue, sometime later in a study that he published just last year in Science. He did it in a different way. He took 49 different studies of cladistic studies of trilobites done by different people, and he sorted through them, weeding some of them out just for lack of consistency. But generally, he was looking at how many characters were scored as polymorphic for different species at different times. So we ended up adding up all these different studies, and which gave him a total of almost 1,000 trilobites, about 5% of the total number of trilobites that existed ever, all 8 orders of trilobites, and he divided time into a series of temporal bins, each one of which included a whole bunch of species. And then he found, here's what he found, basically. As you go through the Paleozoic, from the Cambrian to the Permian, the entire temporal range of trilobites, the number of species, which is shown here, and then the proportion of species, which is shown over there, with at least one polymorphism, really drops. So the solid bars are the non-polymorphic, the hashed bars are the polymorphic, and you can see here in the early and middle Cambrian, there's a huge number of polymorphic taxa, and then it drops off significantly for the rest of the Paleozoic. And so those proportions are just shown here. Same sorts of data. This is the same thing, just divided into the temporal bin. This is the early Cambrian, 0% polymorphic, but you can see significant numbers of these are polymorphic, and that holds true in the early and middle Cambrian, and then in the post Cambrian, it just drops off dramatically. I'm going to skip that and go ahead to this, because as I said, I wasn't interested in hearing my own voice this whole time, but that's all that I've heard so far. But I'm kind of coming to the question. So this is the paper that actually made me start thinking about this a little bit more. Kevin Peterson is a guy at Dartmouth. I can't really tell if he's a molecular biologist or a paleontologist. He seems to do both. But he gave a presentation at the Geological Society of America in October, where he said that he thinks we've found the answer to the Cambrian conundrum, as he puts it, and that is through a combination of Mark Webster's trilobite study that I just showed you, and some work and accumulating work on microRNAs. And so here's what he said. First, phenotypic variation decreases through geologic time, and that is based entirely on the Mark Webster study that I just showed you with the trilobite polymorphisms. And then second and third, things that I assume that many of you are much more familiar with than I, microRNAs, which regulate the precision of genic output, he argues are continuously being added to the metazoan genome, and so he thinks this is an explanation for this pattern, this secular pattern of variability over geologic time. To me, this makes a prediction that you should be able to quantify intraspecific variability in the Cambrian, and then in the Carboniferous, and then in the Cretaceous, and then in the Eocene, and you would always have it declining, I think. That's part of my question for you guys. So this is one way to look at the genome hypothesis, I think. It's another way to look at it. And then I just wanted to show you this, and then I think I have my question, some questions on the page. This is a paper by Eric Davidson and Doug Irwin, you know, a team of an Evo-Devo guy and a paleontologist, a 2006 paper where they describe gene regulatory networks and how they are hierarchically arranged. And a lot of these things, again, I think you, some of you are much more familiar with than I am. But they make sort of some specific predictions here that I thought would be worth, that's why I'm showing you this particular slide. They think that these gene regulatory networks have are hierarchically arranged, and they talk about these kernels that are sort of the highest regulators and would be responsible for establishing phylum and superphylum level characters. And they think that these were assembled early on, and this gives you the body plans that emerged in the late Precambrian Cambrian. And then since then, you have modification sort of further down the developmental hierarchy of other systems, which in turn lead to maybe new classes, new families, and then when you get all the way down here, leading to just species-level differences. And so they argue that, I'm not completely, this is what they say, that this represents a challenge to the generally time-homogeneous view of most evolutionary biologists. I'm not really sure that most evolutionary biologists had a completely time-homogeneous view. Since I think everybody is aware of the Cambrian explosion to start with, we know that that this isn't how diversity played out in the fossil record. Nonetheless, this is their proposal, which I would simply invite you to comment on. And then I just have two more slides, and then I'm going to stop talking no matter what. This is a quote from Nigel Hughes, which I really, really like. He's talking about the Mark Webster study with the trilobite polymorphisms and sort of establishing why you'd want to look at that anyway. And he says, okay, well, we know that lots of things were established around the base of the Cambrian, and trilobites don't even come in until 20 million years later. So he says, well, it's clear that the major differentiation both within and among animal phyla was already established by that time. In other words, we have all these stem group bilaterians, etc., before this. It's still possible that patterns of variation in early Cambrian species might reflect a warm afterglow of the Cambrian radiation. I really like this because, and this is part of the question that I want to pose to you. If indeed there is some sort of higher level regulatory system that gets worked out to establish these body plans, would you expect a warm afterglow that would last up into the Cambrian? That's so the warm afterglow comes from that. And then the warm afterglow on the slide, I don't know what that comes from, but so these are my questions, and this is my last slide. Should we expect a warm afterglow? In other words, is this something that you would expect to see sort of played out more slowly than the somewhat 50 million years of the Cambrian explosion, or would you expect to see a sign of it some kind of warm afterglow expressed throughout the whole Phanerozoic, or maybe just in the Paleozoic? Do different Evo-Devo ideas, and I just sort of alluded to two of them, but there are others, of course, do they make predictions that are testable in the fossil record? Because obviously you guys can work on your genes, and we can work in the fossil record, but it's nice to figure out if there are things that we see that you can test, or things that you see that we can test. And so I don't know if there are different, certainly there are different ideas around about the evolution of gene regulatory systems. Do those make any predictions that could be testable in the fossil record? For instance, can we test various genome hypotheses and contrast genome hypotheses with the ecospace hypothesis by looking at secular patterns in intraspecific variation. The trial by polymorphisms is one way to do it, but maybe you could also just approach it with a more direct study of intraspecific variability in fossils from the Cambrian up on through the Phanerozoic. That's all I have to say, or those are the questions that I have, and I would welcome hearing anything that anybody has to say.